Malahide.
Are you sure?
Betancourt asked. The Inquisition will want to plunder his brain. Our ragged, battered party left the dark uplands and retraced our steps to the hazy levels of the beach. The booming had increased in volume and frequency, and the sky was growing dark.
It is as if, said Amos ominously, this place is coming to an end.
We don't want to be here when that happens, I said. From the beach we could see the two Imperial frigates, and the merchantman had departed. A wind, thick with an afterburn of ammonia, was picking up. Their vacuum suits, more or less intact, Midas and Loink went ahead to recover the gun cutter. My vox-link crackled. Maxilla's voice suddenly sang out.
Eisenhorn, for pity's sake, are you there? Are you there? Three ships just left, moving right past me. Conditions are worsening. I cannot stay here much longer. Respond, please respond.
Maxilla, this is Eisenhorn. Can you hear me? We need you to move in and pick us up. We have injuries. Fischig and several others. This whole environment may be collapsing. Repeat, I need you to move the SN into my location and pick us up. A moment or two of static. Then his answer.
As you instruct, Gregor, but it's not going to be easy. Say again, what did you say about Fischig?
He's hurt, Maxilla. Come and get us.
Hurry, Beckwin shouted over my shoulder. We don't want to be here any more.
More static.
Tell Elizabeth I agree with that. Ha!
The echoes, delays, and dislocations were catching up with themselves. The wrongness was righting itself, and, I thought with irony, that made things no better for us.
Chapter 21 A Gathering of Peers. Lord Rawkin contemplates Malahide's secrets.
2 days later, aboard the SN, at anchor beyond the treacherous reaches of the system KCX-1288, we made our rendezvous with the Imperial Task Force outbound from Gudrun. We'd made good our escape from the world of the plateau in less than 2 hours. As Amos had predicted, the place seemed to unravel around us, as if that apparently timeless realm of the sea, the beach, and the uplands had been nothing but an ingenious construct, a space engineered by the Ceruthi to accommodate the meeting with their human guests. As we rowed the gun cutter back to the waiting SN, the hazy radiance had begun to dim and atmospheric pressure dropped. We were beset by turbulence, and natural gravity began to reassert its influence. The impossible cavity had begun to decompose. By the time Maxilla was running the SN down the dark corridor of arches as fast as he dared, the inner space where we had confronted the aliens was nothing but a dark maelstrom of ammonia and arsenical vapors. Our chronometers and horologiums had begun to run properly again. We left the fractured planet behind, braving flares and gravity storms as we made a dash for the outer system. 40 minutes after leaving that place, rear-aligned sensors could find no trace of the wound, as if it had collapsed, or had never been there to begin with. How the Ceruthi came and went I had no idea, and Amos was little help. We had seen no sign of other vessels or other points of egress from the planet's crust. "Do they live within the planet?" I asked Amos as we stood at an observation platform, looking back at the retreating star through glare-dimmed ports.
"I fancy not. Their technologies are beyond my ken, but I feel that they might have arrived on the plateau through those archways from another world, into a place they had built for the meeting."
Such a concept defied my imaginings. Amos was suggesting interstellar teleportation. Outside the system there had been little trace of the heretical fleet. As far as Maxilla was able to tell from drive and warp wakes, the three ships, no doubt bearing Locke and Datso, had rejoined their attentive flotilla and moved away almost at once into the Immaterium. Other warp indicators informed us that the task force was approaching, no more than 2 days away. We dropped grav anchor, saw to our wounds, and waited. 30 weeks before, as we departed Damask, I had sent my request for assistance to Gudrun via Loink astropathically. I had outlined as much of the situation as possible, providing what detail and conjecture I could, and had hoped the Lord Militant would send a military expedition to support me. I did not demand, as the likes of Commodus Voke were wont to do. I was sure the urgency and importance of my communique would speak for itself. 11 ships loomed out of the Imperium before us, in battle formation. 6 Imperial frigates running out in the van, fighter wings riding out ahead of them in formation. Behind this spearhead of warships
came the battleships Vulpecula and St. Sithus, each three times the size of the frigates, each a bristling ogre of a vessel. To the rear was an ominous trio of cruisers, black ships of the Imperial Inquisition. This was no military expedition. This was an inquisitorial task force. We exchanged hails, identified ourselves, and were escorted into the fleet pack by an honor guard of Thunderhawks. Shuttles transferred our wounded, including the still unconscious Fischig and the prisoner Malahite, to Medicaid faculties aboard the St. Sithus. An hour later, at the request of Admiral Spatian, I also crossed by a shuttle to the battleship. They were awaiting my report. My left arm bound and tightly slung in a surgical brace, I wore a suit of black and my button-sleeved leather coat, my rosette pinned at my throat. Amos, in sober green robes, accompanied me. In the echoing vault of the St. Sithus's docking bay, Procurator Olm Madathine and a detail of Navy stormtroopers waited to greet us. Madathine wore the impressive white dress uniform in which I had first seen him, and the men's blue armor was rich with gold braid and ceremonial decoration. Madathine greeted me with a salute, and we strode as a group towards the elevators that would carry us up into the command levels of the ship. "How goes the uprising?" I asked.
"Well enough, Inquisitor. We understand the Lord Militant has declared the Helican Schism over and quashed, though pacification wars are still raging across Thracian."
"Losses?"
"Considerable. Mainly to the population and materials of the world affected, though some fleet and guard units have taken a beating. Lord Glor's treason has cost the Imperium dear."
"Lord Glor's treason has cost him his life. His body rots on a nameless world in the system behind us." He nodded.
"Your master will be pleased."
"My master?" Lord Inquisitor Phlebas Alessandro Rawkin sat in a marble throne at the far end of a chapel-like audience hall, two decks beneath the main bridge of the St. Sithus. I had met him twice before, and felt no more confident now for those experiences. He wore simple robes of crimson over black clothing and gloves, and no other decoration except for a gold signet ring of office on one knuckle. The austere simplicity of his garb seemed to accentuate his authority. His noble skull was shaved except for a forked goatee. His eyes, deep-set and wise, glittered with intelligence. Around him was his entourage. 10 inquisitorial novices of interrogator rank or below upheld banners, sacred flamer weapons, caskets of scrolls and slates, gleaming tools of torture on red satin cushions, or open hymnals. Flanking them were 4 bodyguards in red cloaks with double-handed broadswords held stiffly upright before their faces. Their armor was ornate, and the full visors had been fashioned and painted into the likenesses of 4 apostolic saints: Olios, Yerido, Manizer, and Cadbon. The masks were flat-eyed and expressionless, and almost naive, lifted exactly from representations on illuminated manuscripts of old. A huddle of dark-robed savants waited nearby, and a dozen cherub servitors in the form of podgy 3-year-olds with golden locks and the spiteful faces of gargoyles circled around, scolding and mocking, on grav-assisted golden wings.
"Approach, Eisenhorn," Lord Rawkin said,
his soft voice carrying down the chamber effortlessly.
"Approach all."
At his words, other figures emerged from anterooms along the sides of the hall and took their seats to either hand. One was Admiral Spatian, an ancient skeletal giant in white dress uniform, attended by several of his senior staff. The others were inquisitors. Titus Endor, in his maroon coat, unescorted save for a hunched female savant. He cast me an encouraging nod as I passed by. Commodus Voke, wizened and shuffling, helped onto his seat by a tall man in black. The man's head was bald and hairless, apart from a few sickly clumps. His scalp, neck, and face were livid with scar tissue from injuries and surgery. It was Haldane. His encounter with the Carnadon had not improved his looks. Like Endor, Voke nodded to me, but there was no friendship in it. Next to him, Inquisitor Shongard, stocky and squat, the black metal mask obscuring everything but his raddled eyes. He took his seat and was flanked by 2 lean, supple females, members of some death cult by the look of them, both nearly naked save for extensive body art, barbed hoods and harnesses strung with blades. Opposite Shongard sat Conrad Molitor, an ultra-radical member of the Ordos I had little love or respect for. Molitor was a fit, athletic man, dressed from head to toe in a tight weave armor body glove of yellow and black check, with a polished silver cuirass strapped around his torso.
His black hair was close-trimmed and tonsured, and he affected the air of a warrior monk from the First Crusade. Behind him stood three robed and hooded acolytes, one carrying Molitor's ornate power sword, another a silver chalice and paten, and the third a reliquary box and a smoking censer. Molitor's pupils were bright yellow, and his gaze never wavered from me. Last to take his seat, at Lord Rawkin's right hand, was a giant in black power armor, a space marine of the Death Watch, the dedicated unit of the Ordo Xenos. The Death Watch was one of the Chamber's militant, chapters founded exclusively for the Inquisition, obscure and secret even by the standards of the blessed Adeptus Astartes. At my approach, the warrior removed his helmet and set it on his armored knee, revealing a slab-jawed pale face and cropped gray hair. His thin mouth was curled in a frown. Servitors brought a seat for me, and I took my place facing the Lord Inquisitor. Amos stood at my side, silent for once.
"We have read your preliminary report, Brother Eisenhorn. Quite a tale it is, of great moment."
Lord Rawkin savored the last word.
"You pursued Glor's heretic fleet to this emperor-forsaken outer world, certain that they planned to trade with a Xenos breed. That trade, you stated, was for an item whose very nature would threaten the safety and sanctity of our society."
"I reported correctly, Lord Brother."
"We have known you always to be earnest and truthful, Brother. We did not doubt your words. After all, are we not here in unusual force?"
He gestured around, and there was some laughter, most of it forced, most of it from Voke and Molitor.
"And what was this item?"
"The aliens possessed a single copy of a profane and forbidden work we know as the Necrotuke." The reaction was immediate. Voices rose all around, in surprise, alarm, or disbelief. I heard Voke, Molitor, and Shongard all calling out questions and scorn. The assembled retainers, novices, and acolytes around us whispered or gabbled furiously. The cherubs wailed and fluttered into hiding behind Lord Rawkin's throne. Rawkin himself studied me dubiously. I saw that even the grim space marine looked questioningly at the Inquisitor. Lord Rawkin raised his hand, and the hubbub died away.
"Is that confirmed, Brother Eisenhorn?"
"Lord, it is. I saw it with my own eyes and felt its evil. It was the Necrotuke. As far as I have learned, the Xenos breed, known as the Saruthi, came upon a lost copy thousands of years ago, and through recently established lines of communication with the Glor Cabal, agreed to exchange it for certain artifacts of their own culture."
"Preposterous," spat Commodus Folk. "The Necrotuke is a myth, and a wretched one at that. These twisted alien filth have fabricated this as a lure for the gullible heretics."
I looked over at Voke and repeated, "I saw it with my own eyes and felt its evil. It was the Necrotuke." Admiral Spatian looked up at Lord Rawkin.
"This thing, this book, is it so valuable that these heretics would throw the entire subsector into schism to cover their attempts to retrieve it?"
"It is priceless," cut in Molitor from across the chamber. "Beyond worth. If the legends of it are even fractionally true, it contains lore surpassing our understanding. They would not think twice of burning worlds to get it, or of sacrificing their entire resources to acquire the power it would bring them."
"It has always been plain," Endor said softly, "that the stakes in this matter have been astonishingly high. Though I am shocked by Brother Gregor's news, I am not surprised. Only an icon as potent as the Necrotuke could have set this bloodshed in motion."
"But the Necrotuke, such a thing,"
Shongard hissed.
"Were they successful, Inquisitor Eisenhorn?"
the Space Marine asked suddenly, staring directly at me. "No, Brother Captain, they were not. The effort was desperate and close-run, but my force was able to spoil their contact with the Xenos Saruthi. The aliens were driven off, and most of the heretics' advance guard, including Lord Glor and a blasphemous child of the Emperor, allied to his cause, were slain."
"I read of this Mandragore in your report," said the Space Marine.
"His presence was fundamental in the decision for my unit to accompany this force. The Emperor's children, terror damn their souls, clearly wanted the book for themselves. They had sent Mandragore to assist Glor in its recovery. That beings such as they took it seriously confirms the truth of my story, I believe."
The noble Space Marine nodded.
"And Mandragore is dead, you say?"
"I killed him myself.
The Death Watch warrior sat back slightly, his brows rising gently in surprise.
"Some heretics escaped your purge?"
Shongard asked. "Two key conspirators, brother. The traitor, Gorgon Locke, who I believe was instrumental in forging the original contact between the Ceruthi and Glor's cabal, and an ecclesiarch named Datso, who I would see as the spiritual force behind their enterprise. They fled from the fight, rejoined the waiting elements of their fleet, and left this system."
"Destination?"
asked Spatian.
"It is still being plotted, Admiral." "And how many ships?" "That bastard traitor Estrin ran with 15.
"He lost at least 2 frigates in that star system. A non-standard merchant ship that I believe belongs to Locke is with them."
"Have they taken to their heels and run defeated? Or have they some further agenda?"
Lord Rorkan asked. "I have further research to make before I can answer that, Lord." Spatian stood and looked towards the Lord Inquisitor.
"Even if they're running, we can't permit them to escape. They must be hounded down and annihilated. Permission to retask the battle pack and prepare to pursue."
"Permission granted, Admiral."
Then Molitor spoke up.
"No one has asked the most important question of our heroic brother Eisenhorn," he said, stressing the word heroic in a way that did not flatter. "What happened to the Necrochuk?"
I turned to face him. "I did what any of us would have done, Brother Molitor. I burned it." Uproar followed. Molitor was on his feet, accusing me of nothing short of heresy at the top of his reedy voice. Shongard raised his own serpentine tones in support of the accusations, while Endor and Voke shouted them down. The retinues howled and bickered across the floor. Both the Death Watch captain and I remained seated and silent. Lord Rorkan rose.
"Enough!"
He turned to the glowering Molitor.
"State your objection, Brother Molitor, quickly and simply."
Molitor nodded and licked his lips, his yellow eyes darting around the room.
"Eisenhorn must suffer our sternest censure for this act of vandalism. The Necrochuk may be a foul and proscribed work, but we are the Inquisition, Lord. By what right did he simply destroy it? Such a thing should have been sequestered and brought before our most learned savants for study. To obliterate it out of hand robs us of knowledge, of wisdom, of secrets unimaginable. The contents of the Necrochuk might have given us insight into the arch-enemy of mankind, incalculable insight. How might it have strengthened us and armed us for the ceaseless fight? Eisenhorn has disgraced the very heart of our sacred Inquisition."
"Brother Shongard." "My lord, I agree. It was a desperate and rash action by Eisenhorn. Carefully handled, the Necrochuk would have provided us with all measure of advantageous knowledge. Its arcane secrets would have been weapons against the foe. I may applaud his rigorous efforts in thwarting Glor and his conspirators, but this erasure of occult law earns only my opprobrium."
"Brother Voke, what's—"
Lord Rorkan began, but I cut him off. "Is this a court, my lord? Am I on trial?"
"No, brother, you are not. But the magnitude of your actions must be analyzed and considered. Brother Voke."
Voke rose.
"Eisenhorn was right. The Necrochuk was an abomination. It would have been heresy to permit its continued existence."
"Brother Endor."
Titus did not rise. He turned in his seat and looked down the hall at Conrad Molitor.
"Gregor Eisenhorn has my full support. From your moaning, Molitor, I wonder what kind of man I am listening to. A radical, certainly. An inquisitor? I have my doubts."
Molitor leapt up again, raging.
"You knave! You horse and bastard knave! How dare you?"
"Very easily," replied Endor, leaning back and folding his arms. "And you, Shongard, you are no better. Shame on you. What secrets did you both think we could learn, except perhaps how to pollute our minds and boil away our sanity? The Necrochuk has been forbidden since before our foundation. We need not know what's in it to accept that prohibition. All we need is the precious knowledge that it should be destroyed, unread, on sight. Tell me, do you need to actually contract Ulrin's pox yourself to know that it is fatal?"
Lord Rorkan smiled at this. He glanced at the Space Marine.
"Brother Captain Steinwolf?"
The captain made a modest shrug.
"I command kill teams charged with the extermination of aliens, mutants, and heretics, Lord. The ethics of scholarship and book learning I leave to the savants. For whatever it's worth, though, I would have burned it without a second thought."
There was a long silence.
Sometimes I was almost glad no one could tell when I was smiling. Lord Rawkin sat back.
The objections of my brothers are noted. I myself commend Eisenhorn. Given the extremity of his situation, he made the best decision.
Thank you, my lord.
Let us retire now and consider this matter. I want to hear proposals for our next course of action in 4 hours.
What now? Titus Endor asked as we sat in his private suite aboard the St. Sithis. A female servitor brought us glasses of vintage Amasek, matured in Nalwood casks. The remnants must be purged, I said.
That's so, and the rest of the heretic fleet. They may have been cheated of their prize, and they may be running now. Perhaps they'll run for years.
But they have the resources of a battle group at their disposal and the will to use it. I will recommend we hunt them down and finish this sorry matter once and for all. Amos entered the chamber, made a respectful nod to Endor, and handed me a data slate.
The Admiral's astro-navigators have finished plotting the course of the heretic fleet. It matches the estimations Maxilla has just sent me.
I scanned the data.
Do you have a chart, Titus?
He nodded and engaged the functions of a glass-topped cogitator unit. The surface glowed, and he entered the reference codes from the slate.
So, they're not running back into Imperial space, no surprise, nor out to the lawless distances of the Halo Stars. Their course takes them here, 56 Izar, 10 weeks away.
In Ceruthi territory,
right in the heart of Ceruthi territory.
Lord Inquisitor Rawkin nodded gravely.
As you say, brother, this business may be less finished than we thought.
They cannot hope to count the Ceruthi as allies, or believe they would give them safe haven. The entente between Glor's forces and the Xenos breed was fragile and tenuous, to say the least, and what peace existed between them was ruined by the violence. Datso must have some other reason to head there. Lord Rawkin paced the floor of his state chamber, brooding, toying with the signet ring of office on his gloved finger. His flock of cherubs roosted uneasily along the backs of armchairs and couches around the room. Twitching their gargoyle heads from one side to another, they watched me keenly as I stood, waiting for a reply.
"My imagination runs wild, Eisenhorn," he said at last.
"I intend to question the archaeozenologist, Malahite, directly. I'm sure he can furnish us with additional intelligence. Just as I am sure he lacks the capacity to resist, displayed by his Aristo master, Uricel." Rawkin stopped pacing and clapped his gloved hands together with a decisive smack. Startled, the cherubs flew up into the air and began mobbing around the high ceiling.
"Course will be laid for 56 Izar at once," said Lord Rawkin, ignoring their lisping squawk. "Bring me your findings without delay."
Naval security had imprisoned Girolamo Malahite in the secure wing of the battleship's Medicaid facility. The injury I had given him had been treated, but no effort had been made to equip him with a prosthetic limb. I was looking forward to opening his secrets. I passed through the coldly lit infirmary and checked on Fischig. He was still unconscious, though a physician told me his condition was stable. The chastener lay on a plastic-tented cot, wired into wheezing life-supporting pumps and gurgling circulators, his damaged form masked by dressings, anointing charms and metal bone clamps. From the infirmary, I passed down an unheated main companionway, showed my identification to the duty guards, and entered the forbidding secure wing. I was at a second checkpoint, at the entrance to the gloomy cell block itself, when I heard screaming ringing from a cell beyond. I pushed past the guards and, with them at my heels, reached the greasy iron shutters of the cell.
"Open it," I barked,
and one of the guards fumbled with his ring of electronic keys.
"Quickly, man!"
The cell shutter whirred open and locked into its open setting. Conrad Molitor and his 3 hooded acolytes turned to face me, outraged at the interruption. Their surgically gloved hands were wet with pink froth. Behind them, Girolamo Malahite lay whimpering on a horizontal metal cage strung on chains from the ceiling. He was naked, and almost every centimeter of skin had been peeled from his flesh.
"Fetch surgeons and physicians and summon Lord Rawkin. Now," I told the cell guards.
"Would you care to explain what you were doing here?"
I said to Molitor. He would, I think, have preferred not to answer me, and his trio of retainers looked set to grapple with me and hurl me from the cell. But the muzzle of my auto-pistol was pressed flat against Conrad Molitor's perspiring brow, and none of them dared move.
I am conducting an interview with the prisoner,
he began. Malahite is my prisoner.
He is in the custody of the Inquisition, Brother Eisenhorn.
He is my prisoner, Molitor. Inquisitorial protocol permits me the right to question him first. Molitor tried to back away, but I kept the pressure of the gun firm against his cranium. There was no mistaking the fury in his eyes at this treatment, but he contained it, realizing provocation was the last thing I needed.
I was concerned for your health, brother, he began, trying to mollify. The injuries you have suffered, your fatigue. Malahite had to be interrogated with all speed, and thought I would ease your burden by commencing the...
Commencing? You've all but killed him. I don't believe your excuse for a moment, Molitor. If you truly intended to help me, you would have asked permission. You wanted his secrets for yourself.
A damn lie, he spat.
I cocked the pistol with my thumb. In the confines of the iron cell, the click was loud and threatening. Indeed? Then share what you have learned so far. He hesitated.
He proved resilient. We have learned little from him.
Boots clattered down the cell bay outside, and the guards returned with two green-robed fleet surgeons and a quartet of Medicaid orderlies.
Throne of Terror,
one of the surgeons cried, seeing the ruined man on the rack. Do what you can, Doctor. Stabilize him. The physicians hurried to work, calling for tools, apparatus, and cold dressings. Malahite whimpered again.
Threatening an Imperial Inquisitor with deadly force is a capital crime, said one of the hooded acolytes, edging forward. Lord Rokan will be displeased, said another. Put away your weapon, and our master will cooperate, the third added.
Tell your sycophants to be silent, I told Molitor.
Please, Inquisitor Eisenhorn,
the third acolyte spoke again, his soft voice issuing from the shadows of his cowl.
This is an unfortunate mistake. We will make reparations. Put away your weapon.
The voice was strangely confident, and in speaking for Molitor, displayed surprising authority. But no more than Amos or Midas would have done for me should the situation have been reversed. Take your assistance and get out, Molitor. We will continue this once I have spoken with Lord Rorkan. The four of them left swiftly, and I holstered my weapon. The chief physician came over to me, shaking his head. This man is dead, sir. At Lord Rorkan's request, the warship's senior ecclesiarch provided a great chapel amidships for our use. I think the shipboard curia was impressed by the Lord Inquisitor's fury. We had little time to repair the damage done by the incident, even though the Medicaid had placed Malahite's lamentable corpse in a stasis field. Lord Rorkan wanted to conduct the matter himself, but realized he was duty-bound to offer me the opportunity first. To have denied me would have compounded Molitor's insult, even if Rorkan was Lord Inquisitor. I told Rorkan I welcomed the task, adding that my working knowledge of the entire case made me the best candidate. We assembled in the chapel. It was a long hall of fluted columns and mosaic flooring. Stained-glass windows depicting the triumphs of the Emperor were backlit by the Imperium Vortex outside the ship. The chamber rumbled with the through-deck vibration of the St. Sithis's churning drive. The facing ranks of pews and the raised stalls to either side were filling with inquisitorial staff and ecclesiarchs. All my brothers were in attendance, even Molitor, who I knew would not be able to stay away. I walked with Loink down the length of the nave to the raised plinth where Malahite lay in stasis. Astropaths, nearly 30 of them, drawn from the ship's complement and the inquisitorial delegation, had assembled behind it. Hooded, misshapen, some borne along on wheeled mechanical frames or carried on litters by dour servitors, they hissed and murmured among themselves. Loink went to brief them. He seemed to relish this moment of superiority over astropaths who normally outranked him. Loink had not the power to manage this rite alone. His resources were enough for only the simplest psychometric audits. But his knowledge of my abilities and practices made him vital in orchestrating their efforts. I looked at Malahite, flayed and pathetic in the shimmering envelope of stasis. Grotesquely, he reminded me of the God Emperor himself, resting for eternity in the great stasis field of the Golden Throne, preserved until the end of time from the death Horus had tried to bestow upon him. Loink nodded to me. The astropathic choir was ready. I looked around and found Endor's face in the congregation. He had placed himself near Molitor and had promised to watch the bastard closely for me. Shongard sat near the back, disassociating himself from his fellow radical's transgression. I saw Brother Captain Seinwolf and two of his awe-inspiring fellow space marines take their place behind the altar screen. All of them were in full armor and carried storm bolters. They weren't here for the show. They were here as a safeguard.
"Proceed, brother,"
Lord Rawkins said from his raised seat. The choir began to nurse the folds of the warp apart with their swelling adoration. Psychic cold swept through the vault, and some in the congregation moaned, either in fear or with involuntary empathic vibration. Commodus Voke, helped from his seat by the baleful Haldane, shuffled forward to join me. As a concession to Lord Rawkin for allowing me this honour, I had agreed that the veteran Inquisitor could partake of the auto-seance at my side. The risk was great, after all. Two minds were better than one, and, in truth, it would be good to have the old reptile's mental power at close hand. "Lower the stasis field," I said. The moaning of the astropaths grew louder. As the translucent field died away, Voke and I reached out ungloved hands and touched the oozing, skinless face. The veil of the warp drew back. I looked as if down a pillar of smoke, ghost white, which rushed up around me. In my ears the harrowing screams of infinity and the billion souls cast away therein. Blue light streaked with storm fires, a sound that mingled seismic rumbling and the ethereal plainsong of long-decayed temples, a smell of wood smoke, incense, salt water, blood. A cosmic emptiness so massive and everlasting, my mind numbed as I raced across it. It was gone in a blink, just fast enough to prevent the sheer scale taking my sanity with it. Another blink. Flares of red, colliding galaxies, catching fire. Souls like comets, furrowing the immaterium. Voices of god monsters calling from behind the flimsy backdrop of space. Blink. Oceanic blackness, another snatch of plainsong. Blink. Stellar nurseries, fulsome with embryonic suns. Blink. Cold light, eons old. Blink.
Gregor?
I looked around and saw Commodus Voke. I had not recognized his voice at first. It seemed to have been softened, as if the event had humbled him. We stood on a slope of green shale, under a pair of suns that radiated enormous heat. Desiccated mountains lined the horizon, looming like fortresses. We moved across the clinking shale towards the sound of the excavator. An ancient monotask, its pistons slimy with oil, dug into the side of a rock face with shovel-bladed limbs. It gouted steam and smoke from its boiler stack and excreted rock waste down a rear conveyor belt into heaps of glittering spoil. We moved past it, and past other excavations in the rock face, where smaller servitors brushed and polished fragments from the exposed strata and laid them carefully on find trays. Malahide stood watching them work. He was younger here, youthful almost, tanned and fit by the suns and the work. He wore shorts and loose fatigues, his skin streaked with dust.
"I thought you'd come," he said. "Will you cooperate?" I asked him. "I've little time to talk," he said, bending down to examine items that a servitor had just placed on a tray. "There's work to do. A great deal to uncover before the rains come in a week or so."
He knew who we were, but still he could not quite divorce himself from the reality around him. "There's plenty of time to talk." Malahide straightened up.
"I suppose you're right. Do you know where this is?"
"No." He paused.
"A fringe world. Now I come to think of it, I've forgotten its name myself. I am happiest here, I think. This is where it starts for me. My first great recovery. The dig that makes my name and reputation as an archaeozenologist."
"It is later events we wish to speak of," said Voke.
Malahide nodded, untied his bandana, and wiped the sweat from his cheeks.
"But this is where it begins. I will be celebrated for these finds, fated in high circles, invited by the noble and famous House of Glor to dine with them and enter their service as a prospector. Uricel Glor himself will recruit me and offer me a lucrative stipend to work for him."
"And where will that lead?" I asked. "Tell us about the Saruthi." He bristled and turned away.
"Why? What can you offer me? Nothing. You have destroyed me."
We have means, Malahite. Things can be easier for you. The House of Glor has doomed you to an unthinkable fate. He caught my eye, curious intent.
You can save me? Even now?
Yes. He paused, and then picked up one of the trays. It was suddenly full of the chipped octagonal tiles from the Damask site.
They had an empire, you know,
he said, sorting through the tiles, showing some to us. The pieces meant nothing.
The history is here, inscribed pictographically. Our eyes do not read it, though. The Saruthi have no optical or auditory functions. Smell and taste, the two combined, in fact, are their primary senses. They can detect the flavors of reality, even those of dimensional space. The angles of time.
How? He shrugged.
The Necrochuk. It warped them. Their empire was small, no more than 40 worlds, and very old by the time the book came into their possession. Carried by humans, fleeing persecution on Terra in the very earliest days. Thanks to their taste-based sensory apparatus, they derived from the Necrochuk more than a simple human eye could read. From that first taste, the profound lore of the Necrochuk passed through their culture like wildfire, like a pathogen, transforming and twisting, investing them with great power. It led to war, civil war, which collapsed their empire, leaving worlds burned out or abandoned, contracting their territory to the far-flung fragment we know today.
They are corrupted. As a species, I mean, asked Voke.
Malahite nodded.
Oh, there's no saving them, Inquisitor. They are precisely the sort of Xenos filth you people teach us to fear and despise. I have encountered several alien races in my career, and found most to be utterly undeserving of the hatred that the Inquisition and the Church reserves for anything that is not human. You are blinkered fools. You would kill everything because it is not like you. But in this case, you are right. The contagion of the Necrochuk has overwhelmed the Saruthi. Never mind that they are Xenos. They are a chaos breed.
He shivered as if a chill wind was picking up, but the suns continued to beat relentlessly. What are their resources, their military capability?
I have no idea, he said, shivering again. They abandoned their spaceship technology centuries ago. They had no further need of it. As I said, the Necrochuk had warped their sensory abilities. They became able to undo the angles of space and time, to move through dimensions, from world to world. They mastered the art of constructing spaces in four dimensions, environments that existed only at specific time points.
Like the one where the trade was meant to take place?
Yes. KCX-1288 was once part of their empire, ravaged in their civil war. They chose it for the meeting because it was remote from their main population centers. They built the Tetrascape inside specifically for us.
Tetrascape?
Forgive me, I coined the term. I thought I might use it in a learned paper one day. A tailored four-dimensional environment. In that particular case, engineered with a human climate. We were their guests, you see.
How was the deal arranged?
Locke, the rogue trader. He was on a retainer to the House of Glor. Had been for years. A mercenary, roaming the stars at the behest of the Glors. He ventured into Saruthi territory and eventually made contact. Then he discovered the existence of the Necrochuk and knew what it would be worth to his masters.
And they agreed to trade. I was becoming impatient. Time surely was running out. He shuddered again.
It's cold, he said. Isn't it? Getting colder.
They agreed to trade. Come on, Malahite. We can't help you if you delay.
Yes. Yes, they agreed. In exchange for the return of artifacts and treasures from worlds they had abandoned and no longer had access to.
Wasn't the Necrochuk precious to them?
It was in their souls, in their minds, woven into their genetic code by then. The book itself was incidental.
And you were employed to excavate the materials that the Glors intended to trade?
Of course. I was promised such power, you know.
His voice tailed off. Beyond the distant mountains, the sky was growing dark. A strengthening breeze scattered loose shale around our feet.
The rains? He said. Surely not this early.
Concentrate, Malahite, or you'll slip away. The Necrochuk is destroyed, the trade prevented, and House Glor is shattered and defeated. So why are Locke and Datso leading their fleet into Ceruthi territory?
What's that?
He asked sharply, holding up a hand for quiet. It was indeed colder now, and chasing clouds obscured the suns. A distant, plaintive threnody was just audible.
What are they doing?
Voke spat. He looked at us as if we were stupid.
Repairing the damage you've done to their cores. The high and mighty masters of the Glor Cabal have masters of their own to please. Masters whose wrath defies thought. They must assuage them for the loss of the Necrochuk.
I looked across at Voke. You mean the children of the Emperor? I asked Malahite.
Of course I do. The Glors couldn't do all this alone, even with their power and influence. They made a pact with that foul legion for support and security, in return promising to share the Necrochuk with them. And now that's gone, the children of the Emperor will be most displeased.
And how do they hope to avoid this displeasure and make amends?
Voke asked. Like me, he was becoming alarmed by the stain in the sky and the sound in the wind.
By obtaining another Necrochuk, I said,
realizing, answering for Malahite. The archaeoxenologist clapped his hands and smiled.
Brains at last. Just when I was giving up hope for you. Well done. There is another?
Asked Voke with a stammer. The Ceruthi happily traded back their human copy, because they had their own, I said, cursing myself for not seeing the obvious sense before.
Well done again. Indeed they have, Inquisitor.
Malahite was gleeful and smiling, though he was clearly shivering now, and desperate for warmth.
It's a Xenos transcription, of course, composed in their, I'd say language, but perhaps flavor is a better word. However, the arcane knowledge it contains is still the same. Datso and his masters will have the Necrochuk, despite the setbacks you have caused.
Lightning flashed, and the wind lifted walls of dust and storms of shale particles around us.
Our time is up,
Voke cried to me.
How true, said Malahite. And now, your promise. I have answered you fully. Are you men of your word?
We can't save you from death, Malahite, Voke told him. But the abominations you have chosen to align yourself with are coming to consume your soul. We can at least be merciful and extinguish your spirit now, before they arrive.
Malahite grinned, flecks of shale clicking off his exposed teeth.
Damn your offer, Commodus Voke, and damn you both.
Move, Voke, I cried. Malahite had simply been keeping us talking, padding his story out. He knew damn well we had nothing much to offer him, except a swift end. That didn't interest him. He wanted revenge. That was his price for speaking. He wanted to make sure we were still here when the end came, to die with him. The desert behind him ruptured upwards, throwing rock and dust into the cyclonic gale. A column of blood exploded out of the ground like a geyser, half a kilometer wide and a dozen high. It rose like a gigantic tree, swirling with pustular flesh, sinew, muscle, ragged tissue, and a million staring eyes that coated it like glistening foam. Branch-like tendrils of bone and tissue whipped out from the swirling, semi-fluid behemoth and tore Malahite apart. It was the most complete, most devastating fate I have ever seen a man suffer. But he was still smiling, triumphantly, as it happened. Chapter 22. In the mouth of the warp. A mandate to purge. 56. Izar. The psychically manifested memory of the fringe world and its excavation site blurred away, shattering like an image in a broken mirror. But the towering demon form remained, keening in the lethal darkness, driving the tempest of damnation down upon us. I felt Voke lash out with his mind against the thing, but it was a futile gesture, like a man exhaling in the face of a hurricane. Back! I yelled, my voice lost and distant even to me. I saw him falling into the void at my side, reaching for me. I yelled his name again, holding out my hand. He cried out an answer I couldn't hear. Instead, I heard shouting, screaming, and the blast of gunfire. I sprawled painfully onto the cold, paved floor of the chapel, soaked with blood and plasmic residue, gasping for air, my heart bursting. The noises now were all around me, deafening and clear. I rolled. Panic was emptying the chapel. Priests and novices alike, acolytes and retainers, all were fleeing, wailing, overturning pews. Lord Rawkin was on his feet, his face pale, and his devoted bodyguard, with their saintly masks, were charging forward, their broadswords whirring as they described masterful figures of eight. I saw Voke, unconscious, nearby. Like me, he was saturated with inhuman gore and the drooling liquor of the immaterium. I couldn't find my balance, and there was a dullness in my head. I retched clots of blood. I knew I was damned, damned by the warp, ruined and stained. I had strayed too close too long. The astropaths were staggering backwards, frantic, shrieking. Some were already dead, and others were convulsing or hemorrhaging. As I looked up, two exploded simultaneously, like blood-filled blisters. Arcs of warp energy flashed among them, frying minds, fusing bones, and boiling body fluid. Malahide's corpse had gone. In its place on the plinth crouched a thrashing, screeching horror of smoke and rotting bone. The astropaths had broken the link, having staunchly sustained it long enough for Voke and I to escape. But something had come back with us. It had no form, but suggested many, as a shadow on a wall or a cloud in the sky might flicker and resemble many things in a passing moment. Inside its fluttering robes of smoke, starlight shone and teeth flashed. The first of Rawkin's bodyguards was on it, slicing with his sword. The razor-keen blade, engraved with votive blessings and curial sacraments, passed harmlessly through wispy, ethereal fog. In response, a long, attenuated claw of jointed bone, like a scythe with human teeth growing from the blade edge, lashed out and chopped through his torso and his holy blade, bisecting both. I fumbled for a weapon, any damn weapon. There was a cacophony of gunfire. Storm bolters blasting, the three Death Watch Marines advanced towards the horror. Their black armor was rimed with psychic frost. Over his vox speaker, Seinwolf could be heard, admonishing the foe and barking tactical instructions to his comrades. Their chapter-wrought bolters continued to boom in unison until the unremitting fire had blasted the thing from the warp backwards in a scrambling, shrieking smear of blackness and bone limbs. It fell back off the plinth into the retreating astropaths, crushing dead and living alike. Brother Captain Seinwolf moved ahead of his companions, faster than seemed to me possible for such a heavily armored form. Tossing aside his spent bolter, he drew his chainsword and hacked again and again into the writhing mass, driving it backwards into the adulatory stalls, which splintered like tinderwood. Lord Rawkin strode past me, wielding a ceremonial silver flamer he had snatched from one of his attendants. The acolyte ran behind, struggling to hold on to the gold-inlaid fuel tanks and keep pace with his master. Rawkin's voice sang out above the mayhem, "Spirit of noxious immateria, be gone from hence! For as the Emperor of Mankind, manifold be his blessings, watches over me, so I will not fear the shadow of the warp." Holy fire spurted from the Lord Inquisitor's weapon and washed across the warp-spawned thing. Lord Rawkin was chanting the rite of banishment at the top of his lungs. Endor pulled me to my feet, and we both lent our voices to the words. There was a tremor that seemed to vibrate the entire ship. Then nothing remained of the vile creature, except a layer of ash and the devastation it had wrought. As penance for the act of transgression that had led to this warp invasion, Conrad Molitor was charged with rededicating and reconsecrating the violated chapel. The work, overseen by the archpriests of the Curia and the techno-adepts of the glorious Omnissiah, took all the first 6 weeks of our 10-week transit time to 56 Izar. Molitor took his duties seriously, dressed himself in a filthy sackcloth shirt of contrition, and had his retainers scourge him with withes and psychic awls between ceremonies. I thought he got off lightly. I spent a month recovering from the psychological trauma of the auto-seance in one of the battleship's state apartments. The psychological damage I suffered during that event lasted for years after. I still dream of that geyser of blood, clothed in myriad eyes, filling the sky. You don't forget a thing like that. They say memory softens with time, but that particular memory never has. Even today, I console myself that to have forgotten would have been worse. That would have been denial, and denial of such visions eventually opens the doors of insanity. I lay upon the apartment's wide bed all month, propped up with bolsters and pillows. Physicians attended me regularly, as did members of Lord Rawkin's staff, dressed in their finery. They tested my health, my mind, my recovering strength. I knew what they were looking for. A taint of the warp. There was none, I was sure, but they couldn't take my word for it, of course. We had come close, Voke and I, close to the precipice, close to the edge of irreconcilable damnation. Another few seconds. Amos stayed with me, bringing me books and slates to divert me. Sometimes he read aloud, from histories, sermons or stories. Sometimes he played music spools on the old horn-speakered celiaphone, cranking the handle by hand. We listened to the light orchestral preludes of Dominius Bartholomew, the rousing symphonies of Hans Solveig, the devotional chants of the Ongris Cloisterhood. He warbled along with operettas by Guinglas until I pleaded with him to stop, and mimed the conductor's role when the Marcharius Requiem played, dancing around the room on his augmetic legs in such a preposterous, sprightly fashion it made me laugh aloud.
"It's good to hear that, Gregor," he said,
blowing dust off a new spool before fitting it into the celiaphone. I was going to answer, but the strident war hymns of the Mordian regimental choir cut me off. Midas visited me, and spent time playing regicide or plucking his Glavian lyre. I took these recitals as a particular compliment. He'd been dragging the lyre around for years, ever since I had first met him, and had never played in my hearing, despite my requests. He was a master, his circuit-inlaid fingers reading and playing the coded strings as expertly as they did flight controls. On his third visit, after a trio of jaunty Glavian dances, he set his turtle-backed instrument down against the arm of his chair and said,
"Loink is dead."
I closed my eyes and nodded. I had suspected as much.
"Amos didn't want to tell you yet, given your condition, but I thought it was wrong to keep it from you."
"Was it quick?"
"His body survived the seance invasion, but with no mind to speak of. He died a week later, just faded away."
"Thank you, Midas. It is best, I know. Now play again, so I can lose myself in your tunes." Strangely, I came to enjoy Beckwin's visits most. She would bustle in, tidying around me, tut-tutting at the state of my water jug or the collapse of my bolsters. Then she would read aloud, usually from books and slates Amos had left, and often from works that he had already declaimed for my edification. She read them better, with more colour and phlegm. The voice she put on to do Sebastian Thor made me laugh so hard my ribs hurt. When she got to reading Kurloff's narrative of the Horus War, her impersonation of the Emperor was almost heretical. I taught her regicide. She lost the first few games, mesmerized by the pieces, the complex board and the still more complex moves and strategies. It was all too tactical for her, she announced. There was no incentive. So we started to play for coins. Then she got the gist and started to win. Every time. When Midas visited me next, he said sourly,
"Have you been teaching that girl to play?"
Towards the end of my third week of recuperation, Beckwin arrived in my apartment and declared, "I have brought a visitor." The ruined side of Godwin Fischig's face had been rebuilt with augmetic muscle and metal, and shrouded with a demi-visage mask of white ceramite. His lost arm had also been replaced with a powerful metal prosthetic. He was clad in a simple black jacket and breeches. He sat at my bedside and wished me a speedy recovery. "Your courage has not been forgotten, Godwin," I said. "When this undertaking is over, you may wish to return to your duties on Hubris, but I would welcome your presence on my staff, if you choose so."
"Nissime Carpel be damned," he said.
"The High Custodian of the Dormant Vaults may call for me, but I know where I want to be. This life has purpose. I would stay here, in it." Fischig remained at my side for hours, long into the night, by ship time. We talked and joked occasionally, and then played regicide with Beckwin looking on. At first, his problems in manipulating the pieces with his unfamiliar new limb afforded us plenty of amusement. Only when he had beaten me in three straight games did he admit that Beckwin, in her infinite wisdom, had been coaching him for the past few weeks. I had one last visitor, a day or two before I was finally able to walk and go about my business uninterrupted by periods of fatigue. Haldane wheeled him in on a wire-spoked carrier chair. Voke was shrunken and ill. He could only speak by way of a vox enhancer. I was sure he would be dead in a matter of months.
"You saved me, Eisenhorn,"
he husked, haltingly, through the vox augmetic. "The astropaths made it possible for us to live," I corrected. Voke shook his gnarled, sunken head.
"No, I was lost in a realm of damnation, and you pulled me back. Your voice. I heard you call my name, and it was enough. Without that voice, I would have succumbed to the warp."
I shrugged. What could I say?
"We are not alike, Gregor Eisenhorn,"
he continued, tremulously.
"Our concept of Inquisition is wildly at variance. But still, I salute your bravery and your dedication. You have proven yourself in my eyes. Different ways, different means. Is that not the true ethic of our order? I will die peacefully. And soon, I think, knowing men such as you, maintain the fight."
I was honored. Whatever I thought of his modus operandi, I knew our purposes pointed in the same direction. With a weak gesture, he beckoned Haldane forward. The man's raw, damaged head was no prettier than when I had last seen it.
"I want you to trust Haldane. Of all my students, he is the best. I intend to recommend his elevation to the level of High Interrogator, and from there, Inquisitional rank beckons. If I die, look to him for my sake. I have no doubt the Inquisition will benefit from his presence."
I promised Voke I would do so, and this seemed to please Haldane. I didn't like the man much, but he had been resilient and unfaltering in the face of savage death, and there was no doubting his ability or dedication. Voke took my hand in his sweaty claw and rasped,
"Thank you, brother."
As it turned out, Commodus Voke lived on for another 103 years. He proved nigh on impossible to kill. When Golesh Constantine Phepos Haldane was finally elected to the rank of Inquisitor, it was all Voke's doing. The sins of the father, as they say. Invasion training began 3 weeks off 56 Izar. Initially, Admiral Spatian's plan was for a fleet action, a simple annihilation of any targets from orbit. But Lord Rawkin and the Death Watch insisted that a physical invasion was required. The recovery and destruction of the Xenos Necrochuke had to be authenticated, or we would never know for sure that it was truly gone. Only after that objective was achieved could extreme destructive sanction be unleashed on 56 Izar. All that could be learned from my associates and the surviving Gudrunites concerning the Ceruthi Tetrascapes, ironically we were using Malahite's term by then, was collated during a scrupulously searching series of interviews conducted by naval tacticians and Britnoth, the Death Watch's revered librarian and strategist. The collected information was profiled by the fleet's cogitators, and simulations created to acclimatize the ground forces. To my eyes, the simulations conveyed nothing of the wrongness we had experienced on the world of the plateau. Britnoth himself conducted my interviews, accompanied by Olm Madathine. Shaven-headed, a giant of a man, even without his armor, Britnoth was nevertheless cordial and attentive, addressing me with respect and listening with genuine interest to my replies. I tried to do verbal justice to my memories of the experience, and additionally related the theories that Malahite had expounded during that fateful seance. Eschewing the luxury of a servitor scribe or clerk, Britnoth made his own notes as he listened. I found myself engrossed watching the warrior's paw working the dwarfed stylus almost delicately across the note slate. We sat in my apartments for the sessions, which often lasted hours. Beckwin brought in regular trays of hot mead or leaf infusions, and Britnoth actually extended his little finger as he lifted the porcelain cups by the handle. He was to me the embodiment of war in peacetime, a vast power bound into genteel behavior, striving to prevent his awesome strength from breaking loose. He would lift the cup, small finger extended, consult his notes and ask another question before sipping. The fact that small finger was the size and shape of an RBT's truncheon was beside the point.
What I'm trying to establish, Brother Inquisitor, is whether the environments of the Ceruthi Xenos will hinder our forces or deprive them of optimum combat efficiency.
You can be sure of that, Brother Librarian. I poured some more Oliset tea from the silver pot. My comrades were disoriented for the entire duration of the mission, and the Gudrunite riflemen had broken because of the place more than anything else. There is a wrongness that quite disarms the senses. It had been conjectured by some that this is a deliberate effect used by the Ceruthi to undermine sentience used to three physical dimensions, but the traitor Malahite made more sense, in my opinion. The wrongness is a byproduct of the Ceruthi's preferred environments. We can expect the effect to be the norm on any homeworld of theirs. Britnoth nodded and noted again.
I'm sure your chapter's experience and specialized sensor equipment will be a match for it, put in Mattathine. Myself, I'm worried about the guard. They'll be the mainstay of this action. They've all seen the preliminary briefing simulations, Britnoth murmured.
With respect, I have two, and they hardly do justice to the places we will find ourselves in. I looked across the table into Britnoth's face. His rugged features were sunken and colourless, the common trait of one who spends most of his life hidden within a combat helmet. His hooded eyes regarded me with interest. What wars, what victories had those eyes witnessed, I wondered. What defeats?
What do you suggest?
Britnoth asked. Adverse cross-training, I replied. I'd thought about it long and hard. Olm here knows I'm no military man, Brother Librarian, but that's the way it seems to me. Make the troops practice overburden and off-balance. Blindfold them in some exercises, cuff them in others, alter gravity in the training vaults. Make the weighted packs they carry off-center and awkward. Switch light levels without warning. Crank the temperature and air pressure up and down. Simply make it hard for them. Train them to run, cover, shoot, and reload in off-putting extremes. Make them learn all their essential combat procedures so well they can do them anywhere, under any circumstances. When they hit the ground at 56 Izar, let the fight be all they worry about. Everything else should be instinctive.
Mattathine smiled confidently. The infantry forces at our disposal are primarily navy troopers and Myapwa light elite from the Imperial Guard, seasoned soldiers all, unlike the poor Gudrunite foundees you had to nursemaid, Gregor. We'll put them through the hoops and raise their game for the big push. They've got the combat hours and the balls to do it.
Don't stint, I warned Mattathine. And those foundees you refer to, Sergeant Yarus and his men, I want them with me when I go in.
Gregor, we can give you a crack squad of Myapwa who...
I want the Gudrunite survivors.
Why?
Britnoth asked. Because whatever their combat inexperience, they've seen a tetrascape. Those are the men I want at my side. Mattathine and Britnoth exchanged glances, and the Procurator shrugged.
As you wish.
As for the others, like I said, don't stint on the training regime.
We won't,
he chuckled, mock outraged at the idea.
The drill masters will work the regiments so hard they'll yearn for real battle.
I'm serious, I said. Every man that deploys onto 56 Izar, the venerated Death Watch included, Emperor bless them, should be ready to lose control of his senses, his judgment, his fortitude, and even his basic mental faculties. They're going to be hit hard, but in an insidious way. I don't care if every man jack of them forgets his own mother's name and wets himself. They must still know how to hold a line, fire and reload, adore the Emperor, and respond to orders.
Succinctly put, Britnoth said. I will, of course, temper your proposals before I put them to my battle brothers.
I don't care what you tell them, I chuckled, as long as you don't let on who it came from.
Your anonymity is assured.
He smiled. A wonder, that. I consider myself one of the very few mortals to have made a librarian of the Adeptus Astartes smile. To have seen a librarian of the Adeptus Astartes smile, even. Britnoth pushed his slate and stylus aside and looked over at me with curiosity.
Mandragore, he said.
The bastard child of the Emperor? What of him?
I'm told you killed him yourself. In single combat. Quite a feat for one such as you. And I mean no disrespect.
No disrespect is taken.
How did you do it?
He asked, frankly. I told him. I kept it simple. Britnoth made no reaction, but Mattathine was quietly agog.
Brother Captain Seinwolf will be fascinated, Britnoth said. I promised him I'd find out the details. He was dying to ask you about it, but he didn't dare.
Now that was funny. We prepared ourselves for the approaching war. It was going to be arduous, and unlike most campaigns, not divided into two sides. I observed training sessions, impressed by the efforts and the discipline. I even had the terrifying pleasure of watching Captain Seinwolf's kill team conduct a target decoy hunt through the hold levels. We were ready. Ready as we'd ever be. In the 9th week of transit, Lord Inquisitor Rorkin and Admiral Spatian issued a joint declaration, officially enforced by will of the Ecclesiarchy. A mandate to purge 56 Izar, as the term and parameters are understood in the Imperial Codes. That was the seal on the action. There was no turning back now. We were heading through the Immaterium at high warp to invade and, if necessary, destroy the Ceruthi world. Through my weeks of convalescence, I dreamed little. But on the last night, before our arrival at 56 Izar, the blank-eyed, handsome man returned to stalk the landscape of my dreams. He was talking to me, but I couldn't hear his words, nor understand his purpose. He led me through draughty halls in a ruined palace, and then departed silently into the dream wilds beyond, leaving me alone, naked in a ruin that tottered and crumbled down on me. The Ceruthi were in my dreams, too. They rose through the brick debris of the collapsed palace effortlessly, finding angles and pathways that I could not see. The multiple nostrils on their swaying heads flared as they got the taste of me. Their skulls